They say that proximity breeds familiarity, and familiarity can breed contempt. And whenever it comes to the United States and Mexico, these two cultural powerhouses have been battling it out for cultural supremacy for really since the two nations have begun. Now, whenever it comes to soccer, as the sport continues to grow in the United States, we're seeing battlegrounds being drawn right and left between the newcomer on the block, the U.S., and Mexico, which has been the power in the region forever. These battle lines are being drawn between the two national teams, between the two domestic leagues, for the hearts and minds of the fans who have loyalties to both nations, and of course, for the dual internationals who are having to choose between which nation to represent. Now, to have this discussion, I'm bringing on a guy who I think is probably the world's foremost expert in this subject. He is a native of Los Angeles, California. He spent time in the Academy of Cruz Azul over at Mexico City. He's been a player in Liga MX. He's been a player in MLS. He is a former U.S. men's national team player. He's got 24 caps, 6 goals. He's a veteran of the 2010 U.S. men's national team. And now he's becoming one of the biggest stars in all of U.S. soccer broadcasting. And his show, Football Americas, has become like the go-to for soccer in this country. Hercules Gomez, thank you for coming on.
Sam, that was a better intro than my own agent would have gave me. I appreciate the kind words, my man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. I'm really excited to have this conversation specifically with you. So I think we need to jump in. I want to jump in with Liga MX in Mexico. We know from the demographics that if MLS is going to grow in this country, they really need to go after the Latin audience and specifically the Mexican-American audience. We can see that by all the numbers and indications out there. We know that Liga MX is the number one league in this country, followed by the EPL and then MLS. So that is MLS's opportunity for growth. Now, we got some really good insights about being a fan of both leagues or being a fan of Liga MX while you're an American from these letters that we got from Ricardo Pepi and from David Ochoa, from Julian Araujo, whenever they chose their national teams.
Right.
And those guys, they had a lot of similarities. One of the big ones was that watching Liga MX for them was like a family pastime. They talked about having dinner with the family and then sitting down to watch a Liga MX game. Usually it was the club that was the club of their grandfather, the club of their father, the club that all their aunts and uncles support. It was a really big way that they connected with their cultural heritage. What does Liga MX mean to Mexican-Americans and Americans with Mexican heritage living in the United States? Football might be over, but MLS is coming back and Champions League and European soccer are in full swing. From all the latest odds, totals, player performance props to where the next fired coach is going to land, BetOnline is the number one spot for all your sports betting needs. Head over to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive 50% off your welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use promo code BELIEVE to get started. And it's not just basketball. BetOnline is your source for hockey, boxing, and UFC odds, right to the Olympic coverage, from sports right down to your favorite Vegas casino games. BetOnline is your number one online wagering destination. BetOnline, the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports and play all your favorite games. BetOnline, where the game starts.
I will say it's changing, Sam. You don't choose a Liga MX club, though. Unless, and this is the interesting thing, because I'm seeing a lot of people that don't come from a Mexican cultural background that are taking interest in Liga MX because it's such a huge platform. I mean, you turn on the TV in a Spanish-speaking network, and if it's any type of sport, it's going to be football. It's going to be soccer. And most likely, it'll be Mexican soccer. Most likely, it's going to be Liga MX. And most likely, it's going to be one of probably 5-6 teams, you know, the big teams, the historical four: America, Chivas, Cruz Azul, Pumas, and two of the Monterrey teams, which are like the new powers in Mexican soccer, the Man Cities, if you will, that came into money in the last 15, 20 years and have really, really been spending, and just a lot of clubs are not keeping pace with them. They've been really doing well. I would liken it to football in the South. You know, if you're from the South, you don't pick your team. Your team's been picked for you. You grow up, you're probably going to, if you grew up somewhere in Alabama, your team most likely will be Alabama. You know, if you grew up somewhere in Texas, your team most likely will be a team in Texas. It's very likened to that. These players, David Ochoa, grew up watching Chivas, you know, Efraín Álvarez, his father, a longtime Chivas fan, you know, and so on and so forth. It comes with the territory. You know, when I was growing up, I'd watch Mexican national team games, but I'd have my father talk to me about, you know, Kobe Jones and Eric Winalda and Eric Winalda's dad who had a business in Southern California and used to do business with my dad, you know, like this guy came from where you came from here in Southern California. Look at him now, you know, 94 World Cup scoring a free kick golazo. So I had the benefit of both worlds. I didn't have that football in front of me. You know, it wasn't until 1996 that MLS came about. My first professional game that I saw was when I was 16 years old and I grew up in Vegas, right? And I drove down, you know, with a couple of friends from my club soccer team. And we, you know, after a tournament, happened to catch a Columbus Crew versus, you know, Galaxy game at the Rose Bowl. That was my first taste. So it's different. What does it mean? It means family, you know, in short, Sam. It's what you know. It's that familiarity that you have, that bond with your family, that bond with your parents, grandparents, that gets passed down from generation to generation. There's a funny saying in Mexican soccer: you can change your wife, but not your team.
Well, that's pretty powerful, and that's sort of the sentiment that I'm getting reading a lot of these stories. With that being said, how does MLS in the short term try to win over some of these fans? Is there a chance?
Yeah, there's a big chance, because I don't know if have you ever taken part in watching Liga MX, or is the curiosity of CCL, CONCACAF Champions League, or Leagues Cup maybe the reason that you have built a familiarity with Mexican soccer? You know, I'm not sure if you've ever seen, like, this weekend, we're recording this, and this weekend coming up will be Monterrey versus Tigres, one of the biggest rivalries in Mexican soccer, for my money, the most passionate rivalry there is, and one of the most passionate in the Americas. It's a great spectacle. I think it's getting new fans. It's getting Anglo fans. It's getting fans that have never really taken part in Mexican soccer, never really thought about doing so. Now they're going to do so because it's available to them in a platform. And, you know, at Football America, we're now giving it to them in English. I think we're along with the responsibility of what we do of holding people accountable and keeping you informed is also educating. One of the great things I've heard about people who watch the show is many of whom have no correlation to Mexican soccer, no background in Mexican soccer, would have never watched Mexican soccer, and now see themselves kind of enjoying what they're hearing from us, enjoying what's going on, because we're building storylines, we're building narratives, we're educating on those things. And I honestly think as more and more players from Liga MX come over to Major League Soccer, to Liga MX, the fan, because we see this in world soccer, is going to be drawn to certain players. If you don't have a familiarity with that team, if you don't have a bond with that city, if you don't have a bond with its stars, you will have a bond who you cheer for in some sense or another, you know, whether that's Lucas Alarayan going from Tigres to Columbus, you know, whether that's Carlos Salcedo going from Toronto, I'm sorry, from Tigres to Toronto, vice versa, whatever the case may be. Gustavo Bo, you know, he was at Cholos, you know, it goes on and on and on and on. You may build some sort of relationship with these players and follow them where they go, like we see in world soccer. So as that continues to grow and Mexican soccer continues to develop and Major League Soccer continues to develop, we're going to see a lot more of that. And I really think both will benefit from that.
Yeah, and that's largely how I started watching Liga MX. I mean, I've always watched wherever the Americans are, that's where I'm going to watch. So whenever Hercules Gomez was down in Mexico tearing it up, I watched your games. I watched Tijuana whenever Paul Arriola was over there. I haven't been watching a lot lately because there's not many relevant Americans in Liga MX right now. But I do have – that's my familiarity with the league. Now, you mentioned players kind of cross-pollinating, and that kind of brings me into this quote I have from Liga MX president Mikel Arriola, kind of on the ongoing sort of flirtation between the two leagues, between Liga MX and MLS. He said, MLS is growing 20% per year. In terms of the value of the teams, the last 10 years, Liga MX has grown 5% per year. We think it's a very good idea to grow together and to generate more for our partners and more growth for our players. It goes on to say, Arriola, who previously worked in Mexican politics, acknowledged that as the United States put more emphasis on soccer, it could threaten to shift the balance of power in the region. So he said Liga MX must safeguard its product by implementing smart partnerships with other leagues. So we're kind of talking about in the short term right now. This is more of a long-term outlook. Do you think that as MLS grows and starts to bring in more of these young, exciting players from Liga MX that it's already kind of starting to do, is there a chance that MLS is going to start kind of cannibalizing the fans in Mexico and a lot of the fans in this region?
Maybe. It's definitely too early to tell. It's very difficult to get a Mexican fan who that's all they've ever watched, especially one that lives in Mexico, to all of a sudden tune into Major League Soccer. About the only time we see that, and I call games in Spanish for ESPN Deportes, and we had excellent numbers in the Zlatan years with Carlos Vela. We built up a great narrative, the Zlatan versus Vela. I mean, the interview where Zlatan asked the reporter, like, you know, when the reporter asked Zlatan, you know, you say you're the best player in Major League Soccer, but here in Los Angeles, across town, there's a player, and he's got so many goals more than you, so many assists more than you, and his team's doing better than you. Do you still feel you're the best player in Major League Soccer? And he turns to the reporter and goes, how old is Vela? And he's playing in Major League Soccer. Where was I at that age, you know? That was me. That was me that he told that to, and business couldn't have been better. Latin America was tuning into Major League Soccer. They were watching Carlos Vela do amazing things, 34 goals, 15 assists in 2019 versus Zlatan Ibrahimovic in two seasons scored like 52 goals. It was ridiculous. People were tuning in because of these narratives, because of their stars, because a Mexican star was competing with one of the greatest players of our generation in Major League Soccer, and the platform was there for him. But unless you get more of that, it's going to be difficult because it's not like a MLS fan taking interest because one of their players goes. They're more forgivable with that. They're more accepting of that. Mexican soccer is not. And I think Mikel Arriola understands that they cap themselves. They put a limit on their own success. And I think he also understands that the best thing Major League Soccer does, it's not developing players. It's not giving you a great product. It's not building tradition. It's not the culture of football. It's the selling of a product. Major League Soccer will package and sell a product better than anyone. And I think they realize that. When I speak to coaches coming from Europe, whether that's Major League Soccer or Liga MX, one of the few things they tell me is, I can consume Major League Soccer in Europe. Like, it's easier for me to find. I can't consume Mexican soccer in Europe. I don't know where to find it. So it's viewed as an exotic league. Major League Soccer to MLS media, I'm sorry, to Mexican media and Mexican fans is like if you said somebody's going to go play in China, somebody's going to go play in India, somebody's going to play in Australia. It's viewed exotic, but they don't realize they're just as exotic in the eyes of many proper footballing nations. So that packaging and selling of a league, making it stronger, I think could benefit Liga MX because I cover Liga MX finals, I cover MLS Cup finals. One treats it like a Super Bowl, you know, where there's a media week. They bring in people all over from different countries, different parts of the states, and you cover it and you package it and you try to sell it as best you can. The other one, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get access to their players, to their stars, to tell their stories. They have a certain distrust when it comes to the media, a certain distrust when it comes to if you don't have rights. Whether it's Televisa or Tevazteca or Fox, whoever they are, there's a certain distrust when it comes to that. So I think Mikel Arriola and the businessmen at Liga MX see what's in front of them, the opportunity to package and sell Liga MX better in what, quite frankly, is a pit of money in this land. There's a reason that Liga MX does so well. And if you look at any consumer group, you know, whatever you're trying to sell here in the continental United States, the number one consumer is the young Latino. And they see that. They see how well it draws. They see how much these kids or these people spend. They want to be part of that. They want those dollars. So there's a reason for that.
Now you talk about the MLS's ability to build the spectacle and sort of that's American sports culture in a word, you know, the spectacle. Yeah. This year was the first Liga MX versus MLS All-Star game. And I got to be honest, I ate it up. I thought it was fantastic. What did you think about that game? It was not just the game, the week.
You know what?
The skills, competition, everything.
Yeah, being here in LA, Obviously, we were still very much in a pandemic, in the thick of it. So it has room for growth. But I believe that was, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I believe that was Fox's like best All-Star game that they've had in I don't know how many years. You know, people tuned in. People can say what they want, that they've got whiplash from this MLS Liga MX relationship. But until USA Mexico stops selling, until MLS Liga MX stops selling, you're going to see a lot more of it. In Leagues Cup 2023, you're going to have a mini World Cup for a whole month where two leagues stop. You could say whatever you want, but I guarantee you people will tune in. It's human nature. People enjoy this rivalry. And now that it's getting so competitive, we're going to see a lot more. Because before, the U.S. men's national team versus Mexico wasn't competitive. It took the late 90s, early 2000s to make it somewhat competitive. And then it was a turn, you know, right after the 2014 World Cup. And then all of a sudden, it's coming back again. It's competitive again. If you look at Liga MX versus MLS, it's never been competitive. But if you look at the last 4 or 5 years, things have started to turn. It's habitual to see a Major League Soccer club knock out not just one, but multiple Liga MX clubs in the group phase, the knockout stages, whatever the case may be. So that's still going to be something people consume. It is what it is for a reason. These things happen not by chance.
Now, you mentioned the importance of superstars whenever it comes to attracting eyeballs to these leagues and specifically MLS. Now, let's talk about the national team. And, you know, the same conversation we're having about getting Latino eyes into MLS is the same conversation that's being had about getting Latino eyes to the American national team. What would a superstar, a Mexican-American superstar, a guy who's, whenever I say superstar, I mean a guy banging in goals for like a Manchester United or a Real Madrid, what would that mean to this discussion?
Everything, because representation means everything. I get a lot of DMs, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know, my work email, which is on my Twitter profile, of people a lot of times not commenting on what I say, but more thanking me for what I represent, thanking me for who I am on the platform that I have. Now that's powerful. That's some crazy stuff. You know, I didn't go to college. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a teacher. I don't presume to be a role model, but when you have people thanking you for being a Latino and using your platform in a dignified manner, that's powerful. Now imagine Ricardo Pepi on a Manchester United, Man City, a Chelsea, just banging in goals. Like what that would mean to not only Mexican Americans, but Latino Americans across this country. That's a powerful thing. When I say representation matters, we see a few Hispanic coaches around Major League Soccer, maybe a few here or there in youth soccer, you know, on the youth national team levels, but we don't see them as general managers. We don't see them as presidents. We don't, you know, enough given the representation that Latinos have in Major League Soccer or U.S. soccer. We don't see enough in management positions, ownerships. These are powerful things. These are things people pay attention to. We want to imagine that this world is changing for the better. So we want to also imagine that the world's most popular sport, the most diverse sport in the world, should be a direct reflection in your own country. And oftentimes we don't see that. So it would mean a world to a lot of different people if you had that type of representation.
Now, you're talking about representation and representing this community that traditionally hasn't been represented in this conversation, in this country. I want to move to this cultural discussion that I'm seeing. I don't even know if I have like a question here. I kind of just want to talk to you about this thing that I'm seeing and kind of get your thoughts on it. And what it is we know that Liga MX and the Mexican national team have been coveting the American market. We know that that the Mexican national team plays a lot of home games in the States. We know that Liga MX has made a concerted effort to attract the American fans, and we're seeing that happening. We're seeing that come together. And as we're seeing that come together, we're starting to see a lot more criticism of things that are traditional within Mexican soccer. Things, I think the best example of this would be like the chant at the Mexican national team games. And the American fan base kind of using its pull and gravitas and kind of imposing its American culture on this Mexican thing. And I'm seeing this really interesting discussion develop where I see Mexican fans who may not necessarily be in favor of the chant, but they don't want their culture being discussed and defined by these outsiders. They feel like this is a Mexican problem and we don't want your input on this. This is something we need to have.
That's just stupid, because domestic abuse isn't just a problem between two people. You know, it shouldn't be just left to those two people to figure out. This is homophobic. So why should you just say, well, you figure it out. You figure homophobia out for the rest of us. It's a ridiculous statement to make. What I will say is, it's a homophobic chant. You don't get to decide the power your words or your insults carry. That's for somebody else. And Mexican culture in general, and I'm speaking for in Mexico, I've been in Mexico, I've played in Mexico, largely is, you tell me not to do it, I'm going to do it. And it goes, logic goes out the window. The education goes out the window, because I guarantee you these people wouldn't be yelling that in their workplace. They wouldn't be yelling that if there was fan ID. They wouldn't be yelling that, you know, in front of their parents. They're yelling it because they think it's funny, because they know it hurts, because they think it does damage. Whatever the case may be, it's idiotic, it's stupid. Where I think you're getting at, and I've seen that rhetoric a lot online, is you can't have an opinion because you don't know what it's like. While that may be true for a lot of different things, it's not true in this case. Injustice is injustice anywhere for everybody. So you shouldn't sit back if you see homophobia. If it bothers you, it should bother you, you should say something. And in a place that's supposed to be a family environment, I'm a father too. My daughter's 4 and a half. She's of the age where she goes to games, you know? I want to take her to Angel City. I take her to the Galaxy games and LFC games when I call games. I wouldn't want her to be subjected to that, you know? There are certain things that don't belong in this game. Whether you think it's funny or not, it has nothing to do with culture. It has a lot to do with education.
You know, we're only a few days out from the Querétaro tragedy, and your podcast on that event was absolutely tremendous, and I learned a lot from that. So thank you for that. But, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s, we saw English soccer in particular just kind of overrun by hooliganism. It was a really tragic period in their soccer culture. I think it culminated, I believe it was 1989 with that game, I believe, between Liverpool and Juventus.
Oh, is it Juventus or Rome?
I'm not sure. Those details are not really important. Yes. The important thing is, following that, English soccer really started to clamp down on hooliganism, started to change the atmosphere at the game, started gearing things towards a more fan-friendly atmosphere. Do you think that this event in Mexico is going to have any type of impact like that throughout soccer in Mexico?
Well, Sam, the important detail here is they were actually banished from European football for a number of years following that.
Yeah.
That's why
5 years.
Yeah, that's why action was taken, and that's why change was imposed, because FIFA finally did something. That's the only way these things are going to change, is when the governing body, a federation is supposed to protect and grow the sport, comes in for the betterment of the sport. That hasn't happened here in Querétaro. It's been one of these, like, we won't get in it, they're handling it type of decisions, type of moments, that has many feeling that it's fueled by the dollars. It's fueled by, you know, not disrupting business as usual. It's a sad turn of events that we just saw in Querétaro Atlas. I've been part of Mexican soccer for a long time. I've lived in Mexico. I've been part of that culture. And I said this on the show, the best part about Mexico isn't the awesome tacos you eat, the food. It isn't when you go to the beaches in Cancun. It isn't Playa del Carmen. It isn't all these great spots like the pyramids. It isn't all these things that you get to experience on your vacation. It's the people. It's honestly the people and how great the people are. People will never understand Mexican culture and how amazing their people are. What we saw was likened to organized crime. There were people being left bloodied and half dead and stripped naked as if to showcase as trophies, that we've seen happen in Mexican culture with organized crime. And that's a frightening thing. You know, we saw images of families fleeing, taking a father taking cover over his son so he doesn't get beaten. A father hand in hand with his wife and his two kids, urging their kids to take off their jerseys because it's the opposing team jersey. It's crazy. It's something that no family should ever experience, no fan should ever experience. The last thing you should be thinking about if you go to a sporting event is your safety. So, you know, these events are unfortunate because it paints such amazing people in a negative light. And I think that's where a lot of these comments that we're referring to, Sam, about you can't comment on this, leave this to us, come into play. People are hurt. People are hurt. We're seeing a lot of xenophobic rhetoric as well online because of this, you know, and people are rightfully upset.
Yeah, I saw so many people that night. I follow a lot of Liga MX fans on Twitter, and I saw a lot of them saying things like, "This is it for them in Liga MX. That they're done with the league now." Do you think that event is going to have a lasting impact on fandom of that league?
So the following weekend, when games resumed, because they actually resumed right after that game, there was
crazy.
Yeah, which is nuts. They should have ceased operations. They happened to be three of the biggest clubs that were in play of those games, you know, Chivas, America, Monterrey, three of the biggest clubs there. So nothing was changed. But the following weekend, no protocols have been established. The investigation is still ongoing. They did a manifestation at the 63rd minute, you know, every single game where they got together and there's no violence, you know, no más violencia and all that stuff because the game was halted, Atlas Querétaro, around that same time. And they went business as usual. We had Mikel Arriola on Football Americas, and that episode actually comes out tomorrow. I don't know when this comes out, but that will come out. You probably will already get a chance to see that. But we actually interviewed Mikel Arriola, president of Liga MX, and he guaranteed the safety of spectators. He guaranteed the safety of American Liga MX fans or American fans traveling to Mexico, whether that's for Liga MX or the Mexican national team, U.S. game, whatever the case may be, he guaranteed their safety. On an ongoing investigation, they seem to think they have a grasp of where to go from here, how to keep it safe for everybody. But that weekend, when games resumed, there was a clear dip in attendance, A Pumas versus Cruz Azul game that's a massive, you know, Clásico derby. Clear dip in attendance in Mexico City. Games across Mexico, huge dip. Say whatever you want. I think it's relevant. I think people are rightfully, you know, timid, rightfully want to see where this goes before they invest themselves back into Liga MX. Now, how long that will last, I don't know. But definitely, I think at least for that weekend, people were, I'm going to keep my distance until I figure this out.
Absolutely. One of the things that I found fascinating about your discussion following it was whenever you talked about how important important is not the right word, how influential the ultras are on these clubs in Liga MX, the ultras and the Badas, and you told stories about like this is the ultras actually like talking to the team and having access to the team and kind of having influence within the club. How powerful are these organizations, and is there even a chance that Liga MX would ban these groups league-wide?
We asked Mikel Arriola, and he said that they wouldn't ask to ban them league-wide, but certain clubs have already taken that decision to their own hands. Chivas has taken the decision in their own hands. They will have no barras. It's going to be a family affair at their games. Necaxa actually decided to play with no fans in their game, which was even, you know, a step more extreme. They're starting to take matters into their own hands. But you have to assume that these ultras carry so much weight that Mikel Arriola and the Mexican Federation owners or the owners of these teams that run the Mexican Federation wouldn't just be like, let's just get rid of them completely. It's a crazy scenario where it makes you scratch your head asking why can't they just, you know, get away from these teams. And Mikel Arriola seems to think that these groups of animation, because he wouldn't even call them barras, groups of animation aren't the issue. It's this culture that they've tried to instill from other places that are the issue. Listen, I've had teammates, I've experienced my own dealings with Barras. I've had teammates in different countries tell me their stories. I had a teammate who told me he once played in a South American country, a big club, and the Barra leaders would come and ask for a stipend from the players, like a percentage of their salaries. And it wouldn't be like an ask, it'd be more like a demand. I've had others tell me how certain owners would open their doors and let these ultras come into like the team bus and threaten the players for better results. We just saw Monterrey a few weeks ago. The fans were literally inside the team facility waiting for the players as they drove in behind the gates and were demanding answers from the Monterrey players. You know, it's a crazy situation that, and I said it back then a few weeks ago when this happened in Monterrey, like, the next step could be scary. And then the Querétaro Atlas thing happens. And that wasn't player ultra type of thing. That was ultra versus ultra. So, you know, I'm hoping these ultras have less influence in the game and it can go back to being a family affair, which for many years in Mexican soccer was the case.
Yeah, this whole event has been absolutely tragic. And it's been really disappointing to see how it just does not seem like the things that are being done are enough or even addressing some of the issues. But I do want to move away from that. I want to move to your career, you talking about you as a soccer player and you as an American soccer player. I think the high point of your career, probably the reason why we're talking to each other right now, was that 2009 year in Puebla, whenever you got the 10 goals, whenever you were tied for the league lead and in goal scoring, and you were just on that absolute hot streak. It seems like the striker position is one that is defined by these highs and these lows. And I think we can think of a lot of players right now that are kind of living in those highs and those lows. What, tell me about being a striker and tell me about the high points and the low points. What was a high point from your career? What was a low point? And kind of how do you deal with that, those in-betweens?
So 2010 was a good year. I won the goal scoring title with this guy named Javier Hernandez. He goes to Manchester United. I stay in Liga MX. Yeah. I did it in 700 minutes. I did it not being a starter. I won a league goal scoring title. And that's because I was just the hot hand. Everything I touched would just go in. You're in this moment. You're in this scenario that I've had many times throughout my career, being a hot hand, where, you know, like, I'm confident, you know, things are going well. Just try it type of deal. I played the World Cup and the Club World Cup in the same year. And literally, the following year, I get sold to Pachuca. Big sell, finally making money, nice little check, nice little signing bonus. I'm like, wow, this is what being a professional is about. I get to Pachuca, insane facilities. Now I got players coming from Boca Juniors. I got players who had already played a Club World Cup, you know, all these different things, whatever the case may be. And I don't play. I'm not to the coach's liking. I play 200 minutes the following season after being a goal-scoring champion in Mexico. And I'm like, I don't understand. I'm the same player. I do the same things. I can't get on the field. Or when I'm on the field, I can't get the ball. When I get the ball, I can't find the opportunity. And I think some of these players, like Ricardo Pepi especially, is experiencing that right now. These are things you have to go through as an individual, especially a striker, to know. Now, after that, I knew it was about weathering the storm. I went to Tecos after Pachuca, started banging them in again. You know, I got sold to Santos, probably the best, I would say, form of my career, banging them again. You know, I was on a crazy tear while I was at Santos. We played three finals, two leagues, and one league and two CONCACAF Champions League finals in like an 18-month span. It was unbelievable. I was scoring goals left and right. And you learn to weather those things. I wasn't getting called in from the Nationals. He was very much a Jordan Pefok situation. Jurgen wasn't calling me in, and I would use that as motivation. You would learn how to weather these elements. And that's what I think we're seeing, is a lot of these players are still learning how to weather these elements. Ricardo Pepi's still the same player. Ricardo Pepi's still going to score goals if you put goals in front of him. You put quality opportunities in front of him, he's going to score goals. He just needs those opportunities. How do you get those opportunities? Confidence. How do you build that confidence? You know, that's more repetitions. That's having something go your way and in the outside world. That's just one going in, you know, to show you that it can happen. The floodgates open. And to be measured when they don't go in. Because right now, I'm certain that Ricardo Pepi's questioning whether FC Augsburg was the correct move for him. We had Jurgen Klinsmann on the coach, and he said, we had Jurgen Klinsmann, ex-coach of the U.S. men's national team, German national team, come on the show, and he said that maybe now is not the right time. And he said this months before he went, and he ended up going, and Jurgen was right. I mean, if he's at FC Dallas right now, and the narrative was FC Dallas won't let him go, everybody hates the Hunts. Everybody hates FC Dallas, and they still love Ricardo Pepi, and Ricardo Pepi's in Major League Soccer, probably banging in goals, and he's still the starting number nine, and with a lot more confidence on the U.S. men's national team. I'm not saying that's the correct move. I'm just saying that's a different narrative, and I'm saying it's a different way of him handling things. Jordan Pefok right now, who knows what he's thinking? I mean, the guy can't stop scoring. Unbelievable pace, and he's a different type of player than the pool has. He's literally a guy that you're like, he's going to get me goals. He's good on set pieces. He's good on getting the inner things. He's good in the box, his movements. He's instinctive, and he has goal. He has goals in him. Then you got a guy like Josh Sargent, who, for my money, is the best nine in the pool just off talent alone. You know, technically very good, tactically very intelligent, can play multiple positions, finds himself inside the box, very good with his back. His best attribute probably is that he makes others around him good, but doesn't have that goal scorer's touch like the other two. So it's about learning who you are. It's about kind of riding those waves that any professional is going to have throughout his career, especially a nine. But these kids are so young. Pifak's 22. Ricardo's 19. You know, Josh is at 20, 21. Dike is about the same age. Like Matthew Hoppe's 20. Who else we got in that list? They're all kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned the age. I mean, for a guy like Ricardo Pepi, the timeline between him beginning to get starts for FC Dallas to scoring his first goal for the national team was like 6 months. And then, you know, within 10 months, he's in Germany. It's all happened so fast for him. You, on the other hand, by the time 2010 came around, you were kind of already a seasoned professional at that point. So yeah. At that point in your career, what was it like getting that call up from your national team and getting that opportunity?
Wow, Sam, it's funny because I think about this all the time. Things have changed so much. I was 22 years old, and I was a developmental player. I don't know if you remember those. Developmental players in Major League Soccer. I made $860.
Is that like the Generation Adidas thing?
Not even that. Those guys made money. I made $860 a month, my first contract, at age 19, when the youngest players on the team were 22, 23 years old, rookies out of college. I was 19 years old, 860. Won an MLS Cup with the Galaxy. Following year, I get loaned out to Seattle. Break my foot the first day in Seattle. Shortly after that, I get waived. Never really played. I played one game for like the Galaxy. I come back in 2005. They offer me $1,200 a month, a senior developmental. I'm like 22 years old, 21 turning 22 years old. I don't play half the year. I'm only playing reserve league, in the reserve league that they started, Major League Soccer. The guys who didn't play the night before, the next morning would play against the rival teams, reserves in a morning reserve league. A few notables of that reserve league, Chris Wondolowski, I start scoring a few goals. I'm not even playing as a nine. I'm playing as a winger. I start scoring a few goals. Okay. All of a sudden I start making the roster. Don't play. This is with Steve Samson, ex-coach of Costa Rica, ex-coach of the U.S. men's national team. Summer comes along. Landon Donovan goes to Gold Cup. Albright goes to Gold Cup. Jovan Karofsky goes to Gold Cup. We had a Brazilian guy who got bad run of form, then injured. A bunch of different things happened, and I ended up playing. Ended up scoring one goal, then another goal, then another goal, then an Open Cup. Keep scoring goals. I'd scored something like 10 league goals in half a season, six in the Open Cup, and like five or six in the reserve league in half a season. It was something crazy. I get voted team MVP as a developmental player, and I'm thinking to myself, like a 22-year-old today who does that in Major League Soccer, all that, and I mean like one after the other, is going to get a lot of buzz, and he's going to Europe, He's going to have the hype machine around him, and he's going to Europe. Back then, you had Chris Rolfe, Damani Ralph. You had all these really good players. Taylor Twellman, who I think that year was the MVP. He was already older. but you had these really good players who couldn't get anywhere near these things, you know? So it was different. I'd already experienced that success, but nothing came about it. So when nothing comes about it, it does something to you, you know? Whether that's work ethic or whether that's humility, it does something to you. I don't know what I would have been like if I would have started having that attention at such a young age, having the money at such a young age, because I'm 27 years old when I go to Mexico on a 6-month contract because I had no other offers. And it works out. And not only does it work out, but it works out in my favor where now it's a free, it should be in theory a free transfer, but in Mexico, you're not free, at least in that time. So I have to get sold and I make a transfer fee off a sale from Puebla to Pachuca. So this is a 10% goes into my pocket. Then I get a signing bonus. Then I get a massive contract. Then I get bonus money from the World Cup. Then I get bonus money from the Club World Cup. And I'm thinking to myself, I'd never seen this type of money. You know, the most I had made in Major League Soccer was $52,000 a year. It makes you appreciate things a little bit more, but it also makes you concentrate on what's important. And I think that like laser focus at that stage in my career was like, I've seen the other side of this. I don't want to go back. So if you want to take it from me, literally come take it from me. So it's very different. You know, I had to literally envision like, this is my deathbed. If somebody wants to come and take it from me, like that's, you know, try it type of deal. And it worked out, you know, in that case. And then you would have some low moments, but you knew like the low wasn't as low because you could still get there. So I don't know what I learned out of all that is just riding that wave and the humility, you know, your best I've ever heard, best piece of advice is you're never as good, but you're also never as bad. So, you know, staying even keeled.
So, Herc, one question that I ask all the former national team players that I have on, I mean, you just mentioned sort of your story and where you came from and just all those trials and tribulations, the struggles. You started MLS at a time whenever MLS, it was not a certainty that MLS was going to be around for very long. I mean, it just came off of I think right before you started was whenever the league almost folded.
Yeah, two teams, Tampa Bay and Miami,
really sticky
actually,
situation. Year 2000. Yeah. So fast forward to today, soccer has become the fourth most popular sport in this country. The popularity of this sport has increased tremendously. The popularity for the national team, the popularity for the domestic league. How does it make you feel as someone who has given your life to this sport and is continuing to give to be a part of that growth?
Well, I will say I don't do things for free. So, you know, ESPN, ESPN's it's a nice place to be. But I'm actually the sophistication of the sport. It's why it's being driven and going where it is. And I give you guys a ton of credit because I always joke and say, you guys are my foot soldiers. You guys are our foot soldiers. But in reality, like the content creators, the people that invest so much time into the sport, that love the sport, that demand accountability, like it's not your, not that there's anything wrong, excuse me, not that there's anything wrong with the soccer mom culture, it's a family environment, but the fan has changed. The demand has changed. And people like you, Sam, other content creators, others who are demanding, like that generation, and I see it all the time on my followers, I see it all the time in people I engage with are, you know, first, second, third generation, you know, American / something, you know, Mexican American, Colombian American, Brazilian American, you know, Ukrainian American, whatever the case may be, they grew up consuming the sport a different way, but now very much enjoy what is this, I don't want to say enjoy the soccer culture, but enjoy their football in this country. They just want it being relevant. They just want it being cared to the way that other countries care to their sport. That to me is the best. That is the best feeling. I try to engage with people as much as I can because that's direct to consumer. That's who we're talking to, right? I had somebody literally the other day tweet at Sebastian and I and say, you don't know me, but you soon will. Like I will be on Football Americas. I will be working with you guys. In Spanish, there's a saying, creando escuela. Like we are literally, I don't want to say leaving a legacy, but we are trailblazing. Like what you're doing could be where I am tomorrow, you know? And some fans just getting in the game watching you, The next step could be there. Like, the game is evolving, and so is the how people consume it, and so is the content. And that, to me, is like the greatest form of respect. You know, the fact that there's this new wave of fan, and they see the game the way that we do, and they want the change like we want the change, and they want more. That, to me, it screams volumes of where this country, and I'm just U.S. and Canada, because if we're just talking Major League Soccer, but where football can go, you know, in this area.
Now, you talk about the growth, and I think a big part of that happened at a game in the World Cup in 2010 against Algeria, a game that you were a part of, a game that you actually started.
Yeah.
That has gone down to become one of the most legendary games in the U.S. men's national team history. Can you tell me, this is where we're going to finish up, Herc. Can you tell me about going into that game, what the atmosphere was like, what the talk was like in the locker room, and then leading up to that moment, you actually got substituted, I think, at halftime for Benny Failhaber.
Yeah, and, Benny was at halftime,
what it was like,
man,
watching that from the bench.
How old are you?
I am 33.
Okay. So everybody has that game that, like, turned them on to their national team. Whether that's U.S. men's, Mexican, Canadian, everybody has that game, right? Turned them on to the game. Mine was the 2002 World Cup. I'm 18 years old, and I'm watching South Korea, U.S. men's national team, play against Mexico. And my father is sitting next to me, huge Mexico fan. And the look on his face when Landon Donovan and DeMarcus Beasley ran Mexico ragged, the dos a cero at the World Cup, that game to me is forever engraved in my mind. That game to me is the game that I'm like, these kids, that World Cup, these kids my age are there. I want to be there. We had Matt Turner on Football America's the other day. Matt Turner, who does not have frostbite, the other day on Football America's. And a few weeks ago, we're doing a Road to Qatar series with Sam Borden, which is fantastic. He interviews a bunch of the U.S. men's national team stars. It's fantastic. And he spoke about the 2010 World Cup and how that made him want to be a footballer. That's my World Cup. That's so crazy for me to hear. That is one of the most fantastic moments of my life. Not sporting life, my life. Just insane. I got to live out a dream moment. And this guy is telling me that, like, something I was part of inspired him to be where he is today. I still remember like it was yesterday. I wasn't even supposed to go to that World Cup. I didn't do a single game in the World Cup qualifier. That's like if in today's World Cup qualifiers, somebody who doesn't do 1 minute in the World Cup qualifier 3 months before the tournament gets on a plane. And not only gets on a plane, but plays 3 of the 4 games. And the game I didn't play, I will tell you a short story after this of why I didn't play. But I was a part of that, an integral part of that. And here I am the day before the game. And Jesse Marsh, Mike Sorber come into my room. And they tell me I'm going to start the next day. And I'm the assistant coach. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, the most important game in the history of U.S. soccer. And I'm starting. That's in my eyes what that game was, the most important game in the history of U.S. soccer, and I'm starting. In a game where it was back and forth, I had a few chances. I had one chance the keeper made an unbelievable save on, and I had another chance at point blank I probably should have made. Like, great part of that game, and then you're thinking, like, you go from being tied and you're going to get knocked out of the World Cup to the play down the right, Benny Failhaber, Jozy Altidore, you know, Clint Dempsey, little scramble comes right back to Landon finishes it up. And we're first place in the group, first time in our history in a World Cup. And we're going to the next round against Ghana. It was like one of the most crazy, surreal moments of my life. I still remember coming back to the lodge in Peoria. And the staff at the lodge, like, in celebration with the drums, dancing, our family meeting us there. It was one of these crazy moments I'll never forget the rest of my life. Until this day, like, you pick a game, high importance. That's probably the most important game in U.S. soccer's history, and I was a big part of that. So to me, it's a huge sense of pride, but it's also a huge sense of reflection because, like, for many in today's era, that's the World Cup that turned them on. So that's just surreal to me.
Yeah, and it just goes to show how important World Cups are and why it's so vitally important that the U.S. takes part, because that's where these moments happen, right? That's how these fans are made.
Sam, can I tell you that quick story real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
First game in South Africa. I'd scored some goals leading up to the World Cup against the Czech Republic. I got a goal against Peter Cech against Australia in South Africa. A friendly we played against them. I came on for like 3 minutes to waste time. I bagged another goal. So like Bob Bradley and the coaching staff had faith like I could continue to be that super sub I was when I won the goal scoring title in Mexico, right? It's 1-1 against England in the opening game of the World Cup. Crazy back and forth. England didn't play too well. We're picking up a huge result. Bob tells
crazy
me to get up.
Dempsey goal.
Yeah. Green let that one slip in. Josie had this moment where he turned and hit the post. Like it was crazy. Tells me I'm going on, and there's like 6-7 minutes left in the game, and I'm like, whew, I'm going in. Like all I want to do is step on the field and say I played in a World Cup. I'm going in. It's my dream. It's any footballer's dream to play in a World Cup. I'm going in. The ball doesn't go out of bounds. They're keeping possession. We're keeping possession. The ball won't go out of bounds. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes go by. The ball won't go out of bounds. Literally like 6-7 minutes go by. Finally, I'm not kidding. Like it felt like that long. Finally, the ball goes out of bounds and it's for Clint Dempsey. And you know, a 1-1 tie is a great result for us. So, you know, as he's walking over to come off, I'm giving him like, yo, slow down, dude. Like slow it down, you know. I'm also being a good team and slowing down. But deep down inside, I'm like, dude, get me on the field. Literally about to like shake his hand and go on, the referee calls the game. So I'm like, oh, man. Steve Cherundolo, the coach of LAFC, who's an amazing guy. Like one of the funniest individuals you will ever meet. Just awesome guy comes up to me and he goes, oh man, dude, you almost got in. You know, same thing happened to me, my first World Cup, but you know, don't worry about it. I'm like, what happened? And he's like, I'll tell you later. It's not important. I'm like, tell me later. Steve, tell me now. No, it's no big deal. Steve, just tell me now. He's like, all right. The next day, the guys who didn't play, you know, we trained and I tore my ACL. I didn't get to play in the World Cup. Like, Steve, what is wrong with you? Why would you say that? But don't worry, that's not going to happen to you. So fast forward to Slovenia. We're down, I believe, what was the score? 2-0 or 1-0? I forget what the score was. I can't believe I'm forgetting the score. But two offensive subs. Benny Fehlhaber and I come on. And we were flying. I mean, I think it was 2-0. It was 2-0. We were flying. One goal, second goal, third goal, Moadu goal, got called back. Should have been a legit goal. We should have won that game. We're the first team in World Cup history to come down from a 2-0 deficit and not lose. It was an unbelievable game. Like, subs who came on, we did a good job. But just great spirit heading into that, you know, post-game and whatnot. And the first person to come up to me was Steve Cherundolo. And he's like, I told you nothing would happen.
Herc, thank you so much for coming on, man. This has been absolutely tremendous. And thank you for all that you do for the sport in this country. I mean, you're a tremendous asset. You're a tremendous asset as a player, and you've been a tremendous asset since you've gone on. I know Football Americas is a huge show, but what else are you doing? What else have you got going on out there? How can people reach you?
So I just tried to open this YouTube channel, get some of those clips out, Football Americas, Twitter, Instagram, you know, all these things people consume, TikTok. I'm trying to get the videos out there, get Football Americas out there, where the show is growing, and it's because of everybody who watches, which is amazing. We're going to be in Mexico, in Mexico City, pre and post. We don't have rights, but we don't care. We're going up against the people who do have rights. We're going to bring you guys your content, and we're going to keep it going. Football Americas is going to be at the World Cup. Football Americas is going to be at any cultural CONCACAF sporting event that you think matters. We will be there.
That is awesome, man. That's really exciting. Guys, for Hercules Gomez, my name is Sam, and this is the Yank Report brought to you by Bet Online.